New York City, March 16th, 2014. 10. There is a magic to this evening, a defiant pleasure in a simple act. Addie spends the first hour holding her breath, bracing for catastrophe, but somewhere between the salad and the main course, between the first glass and the second, she exhales. Sitting there, between Henry and Elise, between warmth and laughter, she can almost believe that this is real, that she belongs, a normal girl beside a normal boy at a normal dinner party. She and Bea talk about art, and she and Josh talk about Paris, and she and Elise talk about wine, and Henry's hand finds her knee beneath the table, and it is all so wonderfully simple and warm. She wants to hold the night like a chocolate on her tongue, savor every second before it melts. Only Robbie seems unhappy, even though Josh has been trying to flirt with him all night. He shifts in his seat, a performer in search of a spotlight. He drinks too much, too fast, unable to sit still for more than a few minutes. It is the same restless energy Addie saw in Henry, but tonight, he seems perfectly at ease. Once, Elise goes to the bathroom, and Addie thinks, that's it, the domino that tips the rest. And sure enough, when she returns to the table, Addie can see the confusion on the girl's face, but it is the kind of embarrassment you cover instead of show. And she says nothing, only shakes her head as if to clear a thought, and smiles. And Addie imagines her wondering if she's had too much to drink, imagines her pulling Beatrice aside before dessert and whispering that she cannot remember her name. Robbie and their hostess, meanwhile, are deep in conversation. "Bea," he whines, "can't we just... My party, my rules. When it was your birthday, we went to a sex club in Bushwick." Robbie rolls his eyes. "It was an exhibitionist-themed music venue." "It was a sex club," Henry and Bea say at the same time. "Wait," Addie leans forward in her seat. "Is it your birthday?" "No," says Bea emphatically.
"Beatrice hates birthdays," explains Henry. "She won't tell us when hers is. The closest we've gotten is that it's in April, or March, or May, so any dinner party in the spring could conceivably be the one nearest to her birthday."
Bea sips her wine and shrugs. "I don't see the point. It's just a day. Why put all this pressure on it?"
"So you can get presents, obviously," says Robbie.
"I understand," says Addie. "The nicest days are always the ones we don't plan." Robbie glowers.
"What did you say your name was? Andy?"
And she goes to correct him, only to feel the letters lodge in her throat. The curse coils tight, strangling the word.
"It's Addie," says Henry, "and you're being an ass."
A nervous current runs across the table, and Elise, clearly looking to smooth the energy, cuts into a petit four and says, "This dessert is amazing, Henry." And he says,
"It was all Addie's doing."
And that is enough to tip Robbie like a glass and send him spilling over. He shoves up from the table with a rush of breath.
"I need a smoke."
"Not in here," says Bea. "Take it to the roof."
And Addie knows that is the end of this beautiful night, the door slamming shut, because she cannot stop them. And once she's out of sight, Josh rises.
"I could use one too."
"You just want to get out of doing dishes," says Bea, but the two of them are already heading for the door, out of sight and out of mind. And this, she thinks, is midnight. This is how the magic ends. This is how you turn back into a pumpkin.
"I should go," she says.
Bea tries to convince her to stay, says to not let Robbie get to her, and Addie says that it's not his fault, that it's been a long day, says thank you for the lovely meal, thank you for the company. And really, she was lucky to get this far, lucky to have this time, this night, this tiny glimpse of normal.
"Addie, wait,"
says Henry, but she kisses him, quick, and slips away, out of the apartment and down the steps and into the dark. She sighs and slows, her lungs aching in the sudden cold,
and despite the doors and walls between them, she can feel the weight of what she left behind, and she wishes she could have stayed, wishes that when Henry had said wait, she had said come with me, but she knows it is not fair to make him choose. He is full of roots, while she has only branches. And then she hears the steps behind her, and slows, shivers, even now, after all this time, expecting Luke. Luke, who always knew when she was brittle. But it is not the darkness, only a boy with fogging glasses and an open coat.
You left so fast, says Henry.
You caught up, says Addie. And perhaps she should feel guilty, but she is only grateful. She has gotten good at losing things, but Henry is still here.
Friends are messy sometimes, aren't they?
Yeah, she says, even though she has no idea.
I'm sorry, he says, nodding back at the building. I don't know what got into him.
But Addie does. Live long enough, and people open up like books. Robbie is a romance novel, a tale of broken hearts. He is so clearly lovesick.
You said you were just friends.
We are, he insists. I love him like family, I always will, but I don't, I never.
She thinks of the photo, Robbie's head bowed against Henry's cheek, thinks of the look on his face when Bea said she was his date, and wonders how he doesn't see it.
He's still in love with you.
Henry deflates.
I know, he says, but I can't love him back.
Can't, not won't, not shouldn't. Addie looks at Henry, meets him eye to eye.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
She doesn't know what she expects him to say, what truth could possibly explain his enduring presence, but for a second, when he looks back at her, there is a brief and blinding sadness. But then he pulls her close and groans and says in a soft and vanquished voice,
I am so full.
And Addie laughs despite herself. It is too cold to stand, and so they walk together through the dark, and she doesn't even notice they have reached his place until she sees the blue door. She is so tired, and he is so warm. She does not want to go, and he does not ask her to. New York City, March 17th, 2014. 11. Addie has woken up 100 ways. To frost forming on her skin and a sun so hot it should have burned. To empty places and ones that should have been. To wars raging overhead and the ocean rocking against the hull. To sirens and city noise and silence, and once a snake coiled by her head. But Henry Strauss wakes her with kisses. He plants them one by one, like flower bulbs, lets them blossom on her skin. Addie smiles and rolls against him, pulls his arms around her like a cloak. The darkness whispers in her head, without me, you will always be alone. But instead, she listens to the sound of Henry's heart, to the soft murmur of his voice in her hair as he asks if she is hungry. It is late, and he should be at work, but he tells her the last word is closed on Mondays. He can't possibly know that she remembers the little wooden sign, the hours next to every day. The shop is only closed on Thursdays. She doesn't correct him. They pull on clothes and amble down to the corner shop, where Henry buys egg and cheese rolls from the counter, and Addie wanders to the case in search of juice. And that is when she hears the bell. That is when she sees a tawny head and a familiar face as Robbie stumbles in. That is when her heart drops, the way it does when you miss a step, the sudden lurch of a body off balance. Addie has gotten good at losing, but she isn't ready, and she wants to stop time, to hide, to disappear. But for once, she can't. Robbie sees Henry, and Henry sees her, and they are in a triangle of one-way streets, a comedy of memory and absence and terrible luck as Henry wraps an arm around her waist and Robbie looks at Addie with ice in his eyes and says, "Who's this?"
"That's not funny," says Henry. "Are you still drunk?"
Robbie draws back, indignant.
What? No, I've never seen this girl. You never said you met someone."
It is a car crash in slow motion, and Addie knew it was bound to happen, the inevitable collision of people and place, time and circumstance. Henry is an impossible thing, her strange and beautiful oasis. But he is also human, and humans have friends, have families, have a thousand strands tying them to other people. Unlike her, he has never been untethered, never existed in a void. So it was inevitable, but she still isn't ready.
"Fuck's sake, Rob, you just met her."
"Pretty sure I'd remember." Robbie's eyes darken.
"But then again, these days it's kind of hard to keep them straight."
The space between them collapses as Henry steps in. Addie gets there first, catches his hand, and it lifts, pulls him back. "Henry, stop." It was such a lovely jar she had kept them in, but the glass is cracking now, the water leaking through. Robbie looks at Henry, stunned, betrayed, and she understands. It is not fair. It is never fair.
"Come on," she says, squeezing his hand.
Henry's attention finally drags toward her.
"Please," she says, "come with me."
They spill out into the street, the morning's peace forgotten, left behind with the OJ and the sandwiches. Henry is shaking with anger.
"I'm sorry," he says. "Robbie can be an ass, but that was..."
Addie closes her eyes, sinks back against the wall.
"It's not his fault."
She could salvage this, hold the breaking jar, keep her fingers over the cracks. But how long? How long can she keep Henry to herself? How long can she keep him from noticing the curse?
"I don't think he remembered me."
Henry squints, clearly confused.
"How could he not?"
Addie hesitates. It is easy to be honest when there are no wrong words, because the words don't stick. When whatever you say belongs to only you. But Henry is different. He hears her, he remembers, and suddenly every word is full of weight. Honesty is such a heavy thing. She only has one chance. She can lie to him, like she would anyone else, but if she starts, she'll never be able to stop. And even more than that, she doesn't want to lie to him. She's waited too long to be heard, seen. So Addie throws herself into the truth.
"You know how some people have face blindness? They look at friends, family, people they've known their whole lives, and they don't recognize them?"
Henry frowns.
"In theory, sure."
"Well, I have the opposite."
"You remember everyone?"
"No," says Addie. "I mean, yes, I do, but that's not what I'm talking about. It's that people forget me. Even if we've met 100 times, they forget."
"That doesn't make any sense."
"It doesn't. Of course it doesn't. I know," she says, "but it's the truth. If we went back in that store right now, Robbie wouldn't remember. You could introduce me, but the moment I walked away, the moment I was out of sight, he'd forget again."
Henry shakes his head. "How? Why?"
"The smallest questions, the biggest answer. Because I was a fool, because I was afraid, because I wasn't careful."
"Because,"
she says, slumping back against the concrete wall,
"I'm cursed."
Henry stares at her, brow furrowed behind his glasses.
"I don't understand."
Addie takes a deep breath, trying to steady her nerves, and then, because she has decided to tell the truth, that's what she does.
"My name is Addie LaRue. I was born in Vion in the year 1691. My parents were Jean and Marthe, and we lived in a stone house just beyond an old yew tree."
Vion-sur-Sault, France, July 29, 1764. 12. The cart rattles to a stop beside the river.
I can take you further, says the driver, gripping the reins. We're still a mile out.
That's all right, she says. I know the way.
An unknown cart and driver might draw attention, and Addie would rather return the way she left, the way she learned every inch of this place, on foot. She pays the man and steps down, the edge of her gray cloak skimming the dirt. She hasn't bothered with luggage, has learned to travel light, or rather, to let go of things as easily as she comes into them. It is simpler that way. Things are too hard to hold on to.
You're from here, then?
He asks, and Addie squints into the sun.
I am, she says. But I've been gone a long time.
The driver looks her up and down.
Not too long.
You'd be surprised, she says.
And then he cracks the whip, and the cart trundles off, and she is alone again in a land she knows down to her bones, a place she has not been in 50 years. Strange, twice as long away as she was here, and still it feels like home. She doesn't know when she made the decision to come back, or even how, only that it had been building in her like a storm from the time spring began to feel like summer, the heaviness rolling in like the promise of rain until she could see the dark clouds on the horizon, hear the thunder in her head urging her to go. Perhaps it is a ritual of sorts, this return, a way to cleanse herself, to set Vion firmly in the past. Perhaps she is trying to let go, or perhaps she is trying to hold on. She will not stay, that much she knows. Sunlight glints on the surface of the Sart, and for an instant she thinks of praying, sinking her hands into the shallow stream, but she has nothing to offer the river gods now, and nothing to say to them. They did not answer when it mattered. Around the bend and beyond a copse of trees, Vion rises amid the shallow hills, gray stone houses nestled in the basin of the valley. It has grown a little, widened like a man in middle age, inching outward, but it is still Vion. There is the church and the town square, and there, beyond the center of the town, the dark green line of the woods. She does not go through town, instead, bends around it to the south, toward home. The old yew tree still stands sentinel at the end of the lane. 50 years have added a few knotted angles to its limbs, a measure of width around its base, but otherwise it is the same. And for an instant, when all she can see is the edge of the house, time stutters and slips, and she is 23 again, walking home from the town or the river or Isabel's, washing on her hip or the drawing pad under her arm, and any moment she will see her mother in the open doorway, flour powdering her wrists, will hear the steady chop of her father's axe, the soft hush of their mare, Maxime, swishing her tail and munching grass. But then she nears the house, and the illusion crumbles back into memory. The horse is gone, of course, and in the yard, her father's workshop now leans tiredly to one side, while across the weedy grass, her parents' cottage sits, dark and still. What did she expect? 50 years. Addie knew they would no longer be there, but the sight of this place, decaying, abandoned, still unnerves her. Her feet move of their own accord, carrying her down the dirt lane, through the yard to the sloping ruins of her father's shop. She eases the door open, the wood is rotted, crumbling, and steps into the shed. Sunlight streams through the broken boards, striping the dark, and the air smells of decay instead of fresh scraped wood, earthy and sweet. Every surface is covered in mold and damp and dust. Tools her father sharpened every day now lie abandoned, rusted brown and red. The shelves are mostly empty. The wooden birds are gone, but a large bowl sits half-finished beneath a curtain of cobwebs and grime. She runs her hand through the dust, watches it gather again in her wake. How long has he been gone?
She forces herself back out into the yard and stops. The house has come to life, or at least begun to stir. A thin ribbon of smoke rises from the chimney. A window sits open, thin curtains rippling softly in the draft. Someone is still here. She should go. She knows she should. This place isn't hers, not anymore. But she is already crossing the yard, already reaching out to knock. Her fingers slow, remembering that night, the last one of another life. She hovers there on the step, willing her hand to choose. But she has already announced herself. The curtain flutters, a shadow crossing the window, and Addie can only retreat 2 steps, 3, before the door opens a crack, just enough to reveal a sliver of wrinkled cheek, a scowling blue eye.
"Who's there?"
The woman's voice is brittle, thin, but it still lands like a stone in Addie's chest, knocks the air away. And she is sure that even if she were mortal, her mind softened by time, she would still remember this, the sound of her mother's voice. The door groans open, and there she is, withered like a plant in winter, gnarled fingers clutching a threadbare shawl. She is old, anciently so, but alive.
"Do I know you?"
asks her mother. But there is no hint of recognition in her voice, only the doubt of the old and the unsure. Addie shakes her head. Afterward, she will wonder if she should have answered yes, if her mother's mind, emptied of memory, could have made room for that one truth, if she might have invited her daughter in to sit beside the hearth and share a simple meal so that when Addie left, she would have something to hold on to besides the version of her mother shutting her out. But she doesn't. She tries to tell herself that this woman stopped being her mother when she stopped being her daughter, but of course it doesn't work that way. And yet, it must. She has already grieved, and though the shock of the woman's face is sharp, the pain is shallow.
"What do you want?"
demands Marthe Larue. And that is another question she can't answer, because she doesn't know. She looks past the old woman into the dim hall that used to be her home, and only then does a strange hope rise inside her chest. If her mother is alive, then maybe. But she knows. Knows by the cobwebs in the workshop door, the dust on the half-finished bowl. Knows by the weary look in her mother's face and the dark, disheveled state of the cottage behind her. "I'm sorry," she says, backing away. And the woman does not ask what for, only stares, unblinking as she goes. The door groans shut, and Addie knows, as she walks away, that she will never see her mother again. New York City, March 17th, 2014. 13. It is easy enough to say the words. After all, the story has never been the hard part. It is a secret she has tried to share so many times with Isabel and Remy, with friends and strangers and anyone who might listen, and every time she has watched their expressions flatten, their faces go blank, watched the words hang in the air before her like smoke before being blown away. But Henry looks at her and listens. He listens as she tells him of the wedding and the prayers that went unanswered, the offerings made at dawn and dusk, of the darkness in the woods parading as a man, of her wish and his refusal and her mistake. "You can have my soul when I don't want it anymore." Listens as she tells him of living forever and being forgotten and giving up. When she finishes, she holds her breath, expecting Henry to blink away the fog, to ask what she was about to say. Instead, his eyes narrow with such peculiar focus, and she realizes, heart racing, that he has heard every word.
"You made a deal," he says.
There is a detachment in his voice, an unnerving calm. And of course, it sounds like madness. Of course, he does not believe her. This is how she loses him, not to memory, but to disbelief. And then, out of nowhere, Henry laughs. He sags against a bike rack, head in his hand, and laughs. And she thinks he's gone mad, thinks she's broken something in him, thinks even that he is mocking her. But it is not the kind of laughter that follows a joke. It is too manic, too breathless. "You made a deal," he says again. She swallows. "Look, I know how it sounds, but I believe you." She blinks, suddenly confused. "What?" "I believe you," he says again. Three small words, as rare as "I remember you," and it should be enough, but it's not. Nothing makes sense. Not Henry, not this. It hasn't since the start, and she's been afraid to ask, to know, as if knowing would bring the whole dream crashing down. But she can see the cracks in his shoulders, can feel them in her chest. "Who are you?" she wants to ask. "Why are you different? How do you remember when no one else can? Why do you believe I made a deal?" In the end, she says only one thing. "Why?" And Henry's hands fall away from his face, and he looks up at her, his green eyes fever bright, and says, "Because I made one too." Part 4. The Man Who Stayed Dry in the Rain. Title: Open to Love. Artists: Muriel Strauss, Design, and Lance Herringer, Manufacture. Date: 2011. Medium: Aluminum, Steel, and Glass Sculpture. Location: On loan from the Tisch School of the Arts. Description: originally displayed as an interactive installation in which the aluminum heart, perforated by small holes, hung suspended over a bucket. On a table beside the metal heart, jars of varying shapes and sizes contained different colored liquids, some water, some alcohol, some paint, and participants were encouraged to select one of the glass jars and empty the contents into the heart. The liquid instantly began to leak out, with a speed dependent on the viscosity of the substance poured. Background: this sculpture formed the central piece of Strauss's senior portfolio, a collection of work on the theme of family. At the time, Strauss did not specify which member of her family was paired with which piece, but insisted that Open to Love was designed as an homage to the exhaustions of serial monogamy and a testament to the dangers of unbalanced affection. Estimated value: unknown. Work was given to Tisch by artist for permanent installation. New York City, September 4th, 2013. 1. A boy is born with a broken heart. The doctors go in and piece it back together, make it whole, and the baby is sent home, lucky to be alive. They say he is better now, that he can live a normal life, and yet, as he grows up, he is convinced something is still wrong inside. The blood pumps, the valves open and close, and on the scans and screens, everything functions as it should. But something isn't right. They've left his heart too open, forgotten to close back up the armor of his chest, and now he feels too much. Other people would call him sensitive, but it is more than that. The dial is broken, the volume turned all the way up. Moments of joy register as brief but ecstatic. Moments of pain stretch long and unbearably loud. When his first dog dies, Henry cries for a week. When his parents argue and he cannot bear the violence in their words, he runs away from home. It takes more than a day to bring him back. When David throws away his childhood bear, when his first girlfriend Abigail stands him up at the dance, when they have to dissect a pig in class, when he loses the card his grandfather gave him before he passed, when he finds Liz cheating on him during their senior trip, when Robbie dumps him before junior year, every time, no matter how small or how big, it feels like his heart is breaking again inside his chest. Henry is 14 the first time he steals a swig of his father's liquor just to turn the volume down. He is 16 when he swipes two pills from his mother's cabinet just to dull the ache. He is 20 when he gets so high that he thinks he can see the cracks along his skin, the places where he's falling apart. His heart has a draft. It lets in light. It lets in storms. It lets in everything. Time moves so fucking fast. Blink and you're halfway through school, paralyzed by the idea that whatever you choose to do, it means choosing not to do 100 other things, so you change your major 6 times before finally ending up in theology, and for a while it seems like the right path, but that's really just a reflex to the pride on your parents' faces, because they assume they've got a budding rabbi, but the truth is, you have no desire to practice. You see the holy texts as stories, sweeping epics, and the more you study, the less you believe in any of it. Blink, and you're 24, and you travel through Europe, thinking, hoping, that the change will spark something in you, that a glimpse of the greater, grander world will bring your own into focus. And for a little while, it does. But there's no job, no future, only an interlude, and when it's over, your bank account is dry, and you're not any closer to anything. Blink and you're 26, and you're called into the dean's office because he can tell that your heart's not in it anymore, and he advises you to find another path, and he assures you that you'll find your calling, but that's the whole problem. You've never felt called to any one thing. There is no violent push in one direction, but a softer nudge 100 different ways, and now all of them feel out of reach. Blink. And you're 28, and everyone else is now a mile down the road, and you're still trying to find it, and the irony is hardly lost on you that in wanting to live, to learn, to find yourself, you've gotten lost. Blink, and you meet a girl. The first time Henry saw Tabitha Masters, she was dancing. There must have been 10 of them on stage. Henry was there to see Robbie perform, but her limbs had a pull, her form a kind of gravity. His gaze kept falling back toward her. She was the kind of pretty that steals your breath, and the kind you can't really capture in a photo because the magic is in the movement. The way she moved, it was a story told with nothing but a melody and a bend of her spine, an outstretched hand, a slow descent to the darkened floor. The first time they met was at an after party. On stage, her features were a mask, a canvas for other people's art. But there, in the crowded room, all Henry could see was her smile. It took up her entire face, from her pointed chin to the line of her hair, an all-consuming kind of joy he couldn't look away from. She was laughing at something, he never found out what, and it was like someone went and turned on all the lights in the room. And there and then, his heart began to ache. It took Henry 30 minutes and 3 drinks to work up the nerve to say hello, but from that moment onward, it was easy. The rhythm and flow of frequencies in sync, and by the end of the night, he was falling in love. He'd fallen before, Sophia in high school, Robbie in college, Sarah, Ethan, Jenna, but it was always hard, messy, full of starts and stops, wrong turns and dead ends. But with Tabitha, it was easy. 2 years. That's how long they were together. 2 years of dinner and breakfast and ice cream in the park, of dance rehearsals and rose bouquets, of sleeping over at each other's place, of weekend brunch and binging TV shows, and trips upstate to meet his parents. 2 years of drinking less for her and staying clean for her, dressing up for her, and buying things he couldn't afford because he wanted to make her smile, wanted to make her happy. 2 years and not a single fight, and now he thinks that maybe that wasn't such a good thing after all. 2 years, and somewhere between a question and an answer, it fell apart. Down on one knee with a ring in the middle of the park, and Henry is such a fucking idiot because she said no. She said no, and that wasn't even the worst word. "You're great," she said. "You really are, but you're not." And she doesn't finish, and she doesn't have to, because he knows what comes next. "You're not right. You're not enough." "I thought you wanted to get married."
"I do, one day."
The words crystal clear, despite never being said, "But not to you." And then she walked away. And now Henry is here at the bar, and he's drunk, but not nearly drunk enough. He knows because the world is still there, because the entire night still feels too real, because everything still hurts. He's slumped forward, chin resting on his folded arms, staring through the collection of empty bottles on the table. He looks back from half a dozen warped reflections. The merchant is packed with bodies, a wall of white noise, so Robbie has to shout over the din. "Fuck her!" And for some reason, coming from his ex-boyfriend, it doesn't make Henry feel much better. "I'm fine," he says, in that automatic way people always answer when you ask them how they are, even though his heart is hanging open on its hinges. "It's for the best," adds B, and if anyone else had said it, she would have banished them to the corner of the bar for being trite. 10-minute timeout for platitudes. But it's all anyone has for him tonight. Henry finishes the glass in front of him and reaches for another. "Slow down, kiddo," says B, rubbing his neck. "I'm fine," he says again. And they both know him well enough to know it is a lie. They know about his broken heart. They've both coaxed him through his storms. They are the best people in his life, the ones who hold him together, or at least who keep him from falling apart. But right now, there are too many cracks. Right now, there is a chasm between their words and his ears, their hands and his skin. They are right there, but they feel so far away. He looks up, studying their expressions, all pity, no surprise, and a realization settles over him like a chill. "You knew she'd say no." The silence lasts a beat too long. B and Robbie share a glance, as if trying to decide who will take the lead, and then Robbie reaches across for his hand. "Henry." He wrenches back. "You knew." He is on his feet now, nearly stumbling into the table behind him. B's face crumples. "Come on, sit back down."
"No, no, no."
"Hey," says Robbie, steadying him. "I'll walk you home." But Henry hates the way Robbie is looking at him, so he shakes his head, even though it makes the room blur.
"No," he says, "I just want to be alone."
The biggest lie he's ever told. But Robbie's hand falls away, and B shakes her head at him, and they both let Henry go. Henry is not drunk enough. He goes into a liquor store and buys a bottle of vodka from a guy who looks at him like he's already had enough, but also like he clearly needs it, twists the cap off with his teeth as it begins to rain. His phone buzzes in his pocket. B, probably. Or Robbie. Nobody else would call. He lets it ring, holds his breath until it stops. He tells himself that if they call again, he'll answer. If they call again, he'll tell them he is not okay. But the phone doesn't ring a second time. He doesn't blame them for that, not now, not after. He knows he's not an easy friend, knows he should have seen it coming, should have... The bottle slips through his fingers, shatters on the sidewalk, and he should leave it there, but he doesn't. He reaches to pick it up, but he loses his balance. His hand comes down on broken glass as he pushes himself back up. It hurts, of course it hurts, but the pain is dampened a little by the vodka, by the well of grief, by his ruined heart, by everything else. Henry fumbles for the kerchief in his pocket, the white silk stitched with a silver T. He hadn't wanted a box, that classic, impersonal casing that always gave away the question. But now, as he tugs the kerchief out, the ring tumbles free, goes bouncing down the damp sidewalk. The words echo in his head. "You're great, Henry. You really are. But you're not." He presses the kerchief to his injured hand. In seconds, the silk is stained red, ruined. "You're not enough." Hands are like heads. They always bleed too much. His brother David was the one who told him that. David, the doctor, who's known what he wanted to be since he was 10 years old. "Easy to stay on the path when the road is straight and the steps are numbered." Henry watches the kerchief turn red, stares down at the diamond in the street, and thinks of leaving it, but he can't afford to. So he forces himself to bend over and pick it up. Take a drink every time you hear "you're not enough." Not the right fit, not the right look, not the right focus, not the right drive, not the right time, not the right job, not the right path, not the right future, not the right present, not the right you, not you, not me. There's just something missing. Missing from us. What could I have done? Nothing. It's just who you are. I didn't think we were serious. You're just too sweet, soft, sensitive. I just don't see us ending up together. I met someone. I'm sorry. It's not you. Swallow it down. We're not on the same page. We're not in the same place. It's not you. We can't help who we fall in love with, and who we don't. You're such a good friend. You're going to make the right girl happy. You deserve better. Let's stay friends. I don't want to lose you. It's not you. I'm sorry. 2. And now he knows he's had too much to drink. He was trying to reach the place where he wouldn't feel, but he thinks he might have passed it, wandered somewhere worse. His head spins, the sensation long past pleasant. He finds a couple pills in his back pocket, slipped there by his sister Muriel on her last visit. Little pink umbrellas, she told him. He swallows them dry as the drizzle turns to a downpour. Water drips into his hair, streaking his glasses and soaking through his shirt. He does not care. Maybe the rain will rinse him clean. Maybe it will wash him away. Henry reaches his building, but can't bring himself to climb the 6 steps to the door, the 24 more to his apartment that belongs to a past where he had a future. So he sinks onto the stoop, leans back, and looks up at the place where the rooftop meets the sky, and wonders how many steps it takes to reach the edge. Forces himself to stop, press his palms against his eyes, and tell himself it is just a storm. Batten down the hatches and wait it out. It is just a storm. It is just a storm. It's just... He is not sure when the man sits down beside him on the step. One second, Henry is alone, and the next, he is not. He hears the snap of a lighter, a small flame dancing at the edge of his sight. Then a voice. For just a second, it seems to come from everywhere, and then from right beside him. "Bad night." A question without the question mark. Henry looks over and sees a man, dressed in a slick charcoal suit beneath an open black trench, and for a horrible second, he thinks it's his brother, David, here to remind Henry of all the ways he's a disappointment. They have the same black hair, the same sharp jaw, but David doesn't smoke, wouldn't be caught dead in this part of Brooklyn. isn't half as handsome. The longer Henry stares at the stranger, the more resemblance fades, replaced by the awareness that the man isn't getting wet. Even though the rain is still falling hard, still soaking through Henry's wool jacket, his cotton shirt pressing cold hands against his skin, the stranger in the elegant suit makes no effort to shield the small flame of his lighter or the cigarette itself. He takes a long drag and leans his elbows back against the soaking steps and tips his chin up as if welcoming the rain. It never touches him. It falls all around him, but he stays dry. Henry thinks then that the man is a ghost, or a wizard, or most likely a hallucination. "What do you want?" asks the stranger, still studying the sky, and Henry cringes on instinct, but there's no anger in the man's voice. If anything, it's curious, questing. His head drifts back down, and he looks at Henry with the greenest eyes he's ever seen, so bright they glitter in the dark.
"Right now, in this moment," says the stranger, "what do you want?"
"To be happy," answers Henry.
"Ah," says the stranger, smoke sliding between his lips.
"No one can give you that."
"Not you." Henry has no idea who this man is, or if he's even real, and he knows, even through the fog of drink and drug, that he should get up and go inside. But he can't will his legs to move. The world is too heavy, and the words keep coming now, spilling out of him.
"I don't know what they want from me," he says. "I don't know who they want me to be. They tell you to be yourself, but they don't mean it, and I'm just tired."
His voice breaks.
"I'm tired of falling short, tired of being... It's not that I'm alone, I don't mind alone, but this..."
His fingers knot in his shirt front.
"It hurts."
A hand rises beneath his chin.
"Look at me, Henry," says the stranger, who never asked his name.
Henry looks up, meets those luminous eyes, sees something curl in them like smoke. The stranger is beautiful in a wolfish way, hungry and sharp. That emerald gaze slides over him.
"You're perfect,"
the man murmurs, stroking a thumb along Henry's cheek. His voice is silk, and Henry leans into it, into the touch, nearly loses his balance when the man's hand falls away.
"Pain can be beautiful," he says,
exhaling a cloud of smoke.
"It can transform. It can create."
"But I don't want to be in pain,"
says Henry hoarsely.
You want to be loved."
A small, empty sound, half cough, half sob.
"Yes."
"Then be loved."
"You make it sound simple."
"It is,"
says the stranger.
"If you're willing to pay."
Henry chokes out a laugh.
"I'm not looking for that kind of love."
The dark flicker of a smile plays across the stranger's face.
"And I'm not talking about money. What else is there?"
The stranger reaches out and rests his hand against Henry's sternum.
"The one thing every human has to give."
For an instant, Henry thinks the stranger wants his heart, as broken as it is. And then he understands. He works at a bookstore, has read enough epics, devoured the allegories and myths. Hell, Henry spent the first 2/3 of his life studying scripture, and he grew up on a steady diet of Blake, Milton, and Faust. But it has been a long time since any of them felt like more than stories.
"Who are you?"
he asks.
"I am the one who sees kindling and coaxes it to flame, the nurturer of all human potential."
He stares at the stranger, still dry despite the storm, a devil's beauty in a familiar face, and those eyes suddenly become more serpentine, and Henry knows this for what it is, a waking dream. He's had them once or twice before, a consequence of aggressive self-medication.
I don't believe in devils,
he says, rising to his feet.
And I don't believe in souls.
The stranger cranes his head.
Then you have nothing to lose.
The bone-deep sadness, kept at bay the last few minutes by the stranger's easy company, now rushes back, pressure against cracking glass. He sways a little, but the stranger steadies him. Henry doesn't remember seeing the other man stand, but now they're eye to eye. And when the devil speaks again, there's a new depth to his voice, a steady warmth, like a blanket drawn around his shoulders. Henry feels himself lean into it.
You want to be loved, says the stranger. By all of them. You want to be enough for all of them. And I can give that to you for the price of something you won't even miss.
The stranger holds out his hand.
Well, Henry, what do you say?
And he doesn't think any of this is real, so it doesn't matter. Or perhaps the man in the rain is right. He just has nothing left to lose. In the end, it's easy as stepping off the edge and falling. Henry takes his hand, and the stranger squeezes hard enough to reopen the cuts along his palm. But at last, he doesn't feel it. He doesn't feel anything as the darkness smiles and says a single word.
Deal.
New York City, March 17th, 2014. 3. There are 100 kinds of silence. There's the thick silence of places long sealed shut, and the muffled silence of ears stoppered up, the empty silence of the dead, and the heavy silence of the dying. There is the hollow silence of a man who has stopped praying, and the airy silence of an empty synagogue, and the held breath silence of someone hiding from themselves. There is the awkward silence that fills the space between two people who don't know what to say, and the taut silence that falls over those who do, but don't know where or how to start. Henry doesn't know what kind of silence this is, but it is killing him. He began to talk outside the corner shop and kept talking as they walked because it was easier for him to speak when he had somewhere to look besides her face. The words spilled out of him as they reached the blue door of his building, as they climbed the stairs, as they moved through the apartment, and now the truth fills the air between them, heavy as smoke, and Addie isn't saying anything. She sits on the sofa, her chin in her hand. Outside the window, the day just carries on as if nothing's changed, but it feels like everything has, because Addie LaRue is immortal and Henry Strauss is damned.
Addie, he says when he cannot stand it anymore, please say something.
And she looks up at him, eyes shining, not with some spell, but tears, and he does not know at first if she is heartbroken or happy.
I couldn't understand, she says. No one has ever remembered. I thought it was an accident. I thought it was a trap. But you're not an accident, Henry. You're not a trap. You remember me because you made a deal.
She shakes her head.
300 years spent trying to break this curse, and Luke did the one thing I never expected.
She wipes the tears away and breaks into a smile.
He made a mistake.
There is such triumph in her eyes, but Henry doesn't understand.
So our deals cancel out? Is that why we're immune to them?
Addie shakes her head.
I'm not immune, Henry.
He cringes back as if struck.
But my deal doesn't work on you.
Addie softens, takes his hand.
Of course it does. Your deal and mine, they nest like Russian dolls together in a shell. I look at you and I see exactly what I want.
It's just that what I want has nothing to do with looks or charm or success. It would sound awful in another life, but what I want most, what I need, has nothing to do with you at all. What I want, what I've always truly wanted, is for someone to remember me. That's why you can say my name. That's why you can go away and come back and still know who I am. And that's why I can look at you and see you as you are. And it is enough. It will always be enough.
Enough. The word unravels between them, opening at his throat. It lets in so much air. Enough. He sinks onto the couch beside her. Her hand slides through his, their fingers knotting.
You said you were born in 1691,
he muses.
That makes you
323, she says. Henry whistles.
I've never been with an older woman.
Addie laughs.
You do look very, very good for your age.
Why, thank you.
Tell me about it, he says.
About what?
I don't know. Everything. 300 years is such a long time. You were there for wars and revolutions. You saw trains and cars and planes and televisions. You witnessed history as it was happening.
Addie frowns.
I guess so, she says. But I don't know. History is something you look back on, not something you really feel at the time. In the moment, you're just living.
I didn't want to live forever.
I just wanted to live.
She curls into him, and they lie, heads together on the couch, intertwined like lovers in a fable, and a new silence settles over them, light as a summer sheet. And then she says,
How long?
His head rolls toward her.
What?
When you made your deal,
she says, voice careful and light, a foot testing icy ground.
How long did you make it for?
Henry hesitates and looks up at the ceiling instead of her.
A lifetime,
he says, and it is not a lie, but a shadow crosses Addie's face.
And he agreed?
Henry nods and pulls her back against him, exhausted by everything he's said and everything he hasn't.
A lifetime,
she whispers. The words hang between them in the dark.